Gentlemen, it's time to get in touch with your guy side at POP Fishing and Marine. Explore the marine part of POP. Just past the cash register, through the big doorway, a huge warehouse, open to everyone, filled with boating parts and supplies. A genuine metrosexual free zone. Real work gloves, heavy duty boots, foul weather jackets. No pastel colors here, only marine blue, bright safety orange, zinc and stainless steel. Gear for sailboats and powerboats, pumps, engine parts, trailer parts, coolers tough enough to hold ice for 12 days, anchors, meat smokers. It's time to get your man up and your gear on. Our experts will help you find exactly what you need, and if we don't have it, we'll bring it in for you. Let your guy side out to play, guys. Gear, glory, we got it. POP Fishing and Marine on Pier 38 next to Nico's.
I tell you why I can't find you. Every time I go out to your place, you gone fishing.
You're listening to Go Fish with Mike Buck on AM 690, The Fishing Answer. This segment is being brought to you by the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council at wpcouncil.org. Okay. Now, troll on in.
Come on in and have some fun with us. It's like I was telling you a little while ago. It is really, really neat. Here out in the middle of the Pacific, we know that there's tuna fish and then there's bycatch. Every one of us wants tuna. This is the time of the year that we look about the yellow guys coming in. And it is also a very, very special day internationally, as it is the United Nations has declared May the 2nd World Tuna Day. And boy, oh boy, is it. And we're going to celebrate one of our planet's greatest resources in the ocean, the little tuna fish. And to join us is the communications officer for the Western Pacific Regional Fishery Management Council, Sylvia Spaulding, and senior scientist Paul Dalzell. Hello, Sylvia. Nice to see you again.
Good morning.
You know, it's sort of interesting to me because we all know that your World Tuna Day in Hawaii is almost every day because we are a fishery that is wrapped around tuna. But it's kind of neat because what I've learned so far, and what we're going to learn hopefully today, is that there's an awful lot that goes into this. There's so much stuff about tuna that is not just from the boat into our table, right?
Right, and I think Paul's going to talk a lot about that. I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the UN General Assembly's resolution to have this World Tuna Day on May 2nd, and this will be the first one, and then it will be recognized annually on May 2nd every year.
Every year, and so that means we have a special day.
Right.
What is it going to be? What are some of the things that are happening internationally with it?
Well, even though the UN has declared it as World Tuna Day, they're not putting any funds. They're just encouraging people to celebrate this day. Yeah. So the council has created a poster and is going to be distributing that to a lot of the fishing community. Mm-hmm. And we have a resolution on the back of the poster that talks about the importance of World Tuna to our Pacific Islands, the United States Pacific Islands.
And I'm going to make a way, gang, that those of you that are interested in this, particularly those of you that are teachers or working in civic group, Hawaiian groups or cultural groups or clubs, this would be a great idea to put on your clubhouse wall or to get somewhere seen because it's going to be every May 2nd. This is going to be the first one, which means it might be a collector's item. Yep. I'm always thinking, you know, is this the next valuable poster?
Right. So we didn't put the year on it. We just put May 2nd, so that it'll be good every year. But what the UN wanted us to do was, on this day, is to raise awareness of the value of tuna, the threats facing tuna populations, and the economic and social benefits of sustainably managed tuna stocks, and to share best practice in this regard. And the council has done all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, and by the way, wpcouncil.org is where you go to find out more about this. And when you do it, and I'll give you this a little later on, you go to wpcouncil.org / Pacific-Pelagic, and we'll tell you about that in a minute. Dr. Paul Dalzell, the senior scientist for the council, is also here, and it must be feeling kind of good to have your fish recognized nationally, internationally as being something important. How is this? How do we narrow this down and take a look at the Pacific? We got, I think we rely on tuna fish probably more than any other part of the world.
Well, certainly probably more than any part of what I would say the developed world.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important to recognize, and I want to do a shout out here for Foreign Fisheries Agency and the parties to the Nauru Agreement, because it was their idea to do the World Tuna Day. And those islands, you know, if you think of the, from Palau all the way down through to Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, they all rely on tuna. And I mean, in particularly the small micro states, you know, like Tuvalu and Kiribati. I mean, they've got two or three sources of income. Stamps.
Yeah, that's a good one. Stamps and fish.
Stamps,
yeah,
a bit of tourism.
And what about if you have a fish on a stamp? Now it's really valuable.
Yeah, but you know, and these are places where, with an El Nino, their gross domestic product can go up by one or two orders of magnitude because the fish are in their waters now. So that's it. So that's giving you like a regional perspective. For us in the Western Pacific, 95% of all the commercial fish landings, you add them up, not just Hawaii, American Samoa, Guam, Northern Marianas, 95% of all the commercial fish landings are tuna.
Yeah, and that's why I said, I didn't mean this facetiously, that's why I said there's tuna and there's bycatch, because by far and large. But I think the neatest thing, and you've pointed this out, and we've had a lot of shows about this in different parts of the fishery, is that there's tuna and then there's tuna. There's a bunch of different tunas, and right here in Hawaii, we got a great example of that. I mean, we have kava, we have aku, we have yellowfin, we have big eye, we have all kinds of tuna.
Typically in the sort of tropical latitudes, this is where the purse seiners operate, and they're targeting this huge skipjack resource, or aku. Up here in Hawaii, it's aku is the number one fish caught by recreational fishermen. But our longline fishery, the bit that's not targeting swordfish, which is the less traditional, you know. It's always targeted big eye ahi, and secondly, yellowfin.
But isn't it sort of interesting, because there was a point in time, and I know that since you became affiliated, you know this, where we had a lot of aku boats, and we had a much bigger aku fishery and a cannery that was really reliant on that. It was a big part of it, but it seems that we made the transition away from that pretty smoothly, and those that want to be fishermen are still fishing. They're just catching a different tuna.
Yeah, I mean, I arrived in 1996, and the events that happened with respect to the cannery and the aku fleet just preceded me. And, you know, the closure of the cannery, it was right the death knell of the fishery, because they had no market. Sure, there's demand for aku in Hawaii, but the volume demand was just not there.
It's out of here, sure.
Yeah, so, and I think there's only one or two boats still left operating, and they only work part-time.
But let me ask you this, and this may be science rather than anecdotal information to suggest this. I've always understood, and I know this to be true as a fisherman, is aku does not travel well. I mean, you know, aku is, you got to pretty much catch it and either freeze it or eat it. It doesn't have it doesn't live as long in brine or on the shelf as ahi or as big eye.
Well, I do remember when I lived in New Guinea that they used to brine freeze aku to go to Japan. But I mean, I think, you know, one description of a skipjack is it's a floating blood clot.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good point.
And
for a lot of palates, it's unacceptable.
Yeah.
But for some, it's demanded.
Yeah.
You know,
I know people who are very fond of sashimi. But, you know, clearly the really big sashimi fish is big eye. And it's worth pointing out that our fishery here, while, you know, it's a relatively modest fishery, it lands 80 to 90% of all the fresh big eye into the United States.
Into the country, that's very interesting.
And then I think it's about 50% of the yellowfin and 50% of the swordfish. So it's a big fishery, you know, nationwide.
You know, that's why I thought there's going to be a lot of people out there saying, World Tuna Day, what does that mean for us? I mean, just to have this fish declared one of the biggest resources in the world is pretty important.
Yes.
What's the trickle down? I mean, what's it? What makes our way to celebrate this maybe even bigger and longer than some of the other places that are going to celebrate it?
Well, I think it's truly an iconic fish for the Pacific Islands and for Hawaii. We need to be continually reminding ourselves that when we talk about going out fishing or going to eat fish, that more than likely it will be aku or ahi, possibly tombo, which is albacore, and that you know, people are brought up on this on these species. Yes, there are other fish that are important, and they have their cultural and socioeconomic importance. And I'm thinking they have reef fish and bottom fish. I mean, if you open, if you open open any Hawaiian Airlines magazine, there'll be ads for Hawaii's signature fish, which is opakapaka. But in comparison to what the people eat day in, day out, and particularly processed into pokey, which is now becoming a big deal on the mainland. You know, it's the next hipster craze.
There's pokey, and then there's Haole mainland pokey. I mean, it may, that may not be the same pokey.
Yeah.
But I think what's interesting to me, and maybe we can cover this a little bit, sort of explain it, is that we have been able to develop with certainty, and I know that as a scientist this is important to you, it is not just this huge mass of immigrating, wandering, nomadic fish. That there is that type. But we've actually here discovered, and I think this through council meetings and through fishers' forums, almost everybody is willing to agree and maybe admit that we have an ahi population of our own that doesn't go away from Hawaii.
Well, this is yellowfin.
Yeah.
Yellowfin ahi. Yeah. And yes, it looks like about 80% of the yellowfin, you know, at any one time in Hawaii waters will stay there. They're able to spawn there and feed there or feed here. So why would they, like, you know, what's the attraction to go somewhere else? So we have talked at great length about managing this as a unit stock, but what are its boundaries? You know, we know it's around Hawaii, but how far north, south, east, west does it go? What is its connection to the rest of the Pacific? Now, Big Eye, on the other hand, that is really a migratory fish.
Is it more predictable in that there's a pattern that these Big Eye have been taking for maybe centuries that have been noted by each island group? Big Eye come at this time of the year, they come over there most of the time.
I would think so. I mean, if you watch the behavior of the longline fishery, and you can do this, you know, you sort of like getting snapshots of where the fishery operates, say, every week, and then just making it into a cartoon. Traditionally, the fishery starts off very close to the Hawaiian Islands, and that's because there's a Big Eye feeding run fairly close to Hawaii. And then as the year progresses, the fishery moves north, and then it moves a little bit east. And then as the year comes to an end, it comes back to the Big Island. That's a very rough approximation. And more recently, we've seen the behavior of the fleet is to go a long way north and a long way east. And they're catching, you know, they're very high latitude for a tuna fishery, for a tuna fishery of this type. But they're catching good fish, big fish, and they're having good catch rates.
Interesting, and we can talk about the handling of it, but I think let's go back to a middle. In addition to this being World Tuna Day, the posters that are going to become available actually have a proclamation, if you will, from the local state. And it I think would be sort of interesting to highlight a couple of those points, Dr. Dalzell, with regards to how we can almost, I don't want to say get on our knees and pray for this fish, but in actual fact, it is that important to many of us, and no wonder that the legislature, and if they get behind it, we're likely to be considered a little bit more carefully for things like area closures and quotas and all of these things going down the road based on science, not emotion.
Yeah, I mean, just to give one example, I think the council did a really good job separating the small boat fisheries and the longliners, you know, both targeting the same broad range of species. Right. It was new boats coming in from the Gulf of Mexico, not familiar with the kind of like the rule, the unwritten rules of the code or the rules of the road for Hawaii, and necessitated pushing the longliners a bit offshore. Now the longliners, you know, it's always a little unfortunate to close down areas to fishing because fishing is hunting, and you really need to be able to range over a wide area to respond to changes in distribution and abundance. But this was a relatively small ask, really. But it did a good job. It kept the longliners literally over the horizon, out of sight, and it meant that the small boats could continue fishing. And small boat tuna fisheries in Hawaii do make an important contribution.
Let me tell you, I'm glad you brought that up because I've noticed this, not only am I two decades into the show plus, but I've also been a fisherman for longer than that. And I think that the, I don't want to say tolerance, but acceptance and actual there's a good relationship has developed between the longliners and the trollers, because the trollers know they're not going to where those longliners are going, and the longliners aren't coming into their backyard either. So there's this buffer, if you will. So you don't, most of us that are out fishing for ahi or yellowfin, I should say, or any of the other pelagic game fish, we never see longline boats. They're just further out.
Yeah, and you just showed me a photograph of your last day out. Yeah. I mean, yeah. That's damn successful by anybody's stretch of the imagination.
And it just goes to show you, I mean, we had a good day based on information shared by other fishermen. The particular place where we got these fish a couple of weeks ago, the day before had been fished by a friend who said, I was out at so-and-so area, and it was really great. There was a lot of mai-mai, a lot of otaro, which is the larger size aku. Mm. And so we thought, well, if there's that much, we'll go out and see if we can get some. Everybody that was out there caught fish that day, and it is not an area typically known to have schooling large aku.
Mm.
So who knows what happened? They just happened, right?
Yeah. Well, the other thing, too, we talked about the closure of the cannery, and I think that at the time when the cannery closed, there was something happening with the aku stock. I don't recollect exactly what it was, but I think that I'd have to go back and read the scientific papers, but I think there was... I think that the fish were smaller and getting more scarce at that time.
There was a time when it was said that there were so many aku boats and they were so efficient. Now we look at them, they're not anywhere near as efficient then as they are now. Mm. But it was said that they were catching all the fish. But then there was science to say, well, wait a minute, this is in this cycle. It's not that they're catching the fish aren't there to catch. Mm. So you have to have that. That's maybe why a lot of people must ask you this when you say you're talking about tombo or albacore a little while ago. It seems in Hawaii you only see one size of tombo. That's 60 to 70 pound fish.
Mm.
But they're littler. Where the heck are they when they're littler?
We don't know. Higher latitudes.
Yeah,
and that's why they're targeted by high latitude trawlers, Poland line, even purse seine from Japan, and down in American Samoa. Which is kind of like the analog. Yeah. It's always a little bit near the equator. Yes, they catch big tombo in American Samoa in the longline fishery. But you go further south from there, and there is a very large surface resource of the small fish. The difference between aku and ahi species is that they are equatorial tropical spawners. Mm. The tombo does not, I believe, spawns at high latitudes.
Which is colder.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's why their meat is not as bloody or as red as our
It's the white meat tuna, isn't it? I often wonder why it's not more popular.
Yeah. Well, it's really popular on the mainland.
Oh, okay.
I mean, they pay extra for albacore. They do that. Mm. But let's also revel in the fact that the rest of the world is now celebrating which we celebrate all the time, and this World Tuna Day. What are some of the other things that came up here legislatively where our legislature thought that, and maybe, Sylvia, maybe we'll get you in to come back in for a minute on that, because this World Tuna Day is being further emphasized here. And talk about how it filtered down from the General Assembly of the United Nations to go globally, and everybody embraced it.
Right. So the UN General Assembly adopted the World Tuna Day in December of 2016. And so, it's just in the news media, and we picked it up. There was an invite for everybody to voluntarily celebrate this day so that the council, we celebrated the year of the sea turtle with a poster. We decided let's do this also because Paul had talked about 95% of the commercial catch is tuna or tuna-like species. 90% of the Hawaii recreational catch by weight is also tuna.
By weight.
Yeah. Now, so it hasn't gone to the legislature. We have made this resolution. We are asking the governors out in American Samoa, Sinamai, and Guam to maybe proclaim it.
Oh, wait a minute. That's what I'm saying. What you're doing here is you're stoking the fire.
We're
giving to everybody a look. Look, we're looking at tuna globally.
Uh-huh.
You know how tuna is important to you. Why don't we do something locally, and why don't you spearhead it?
Right. So the resolution that's in the back of the poster, and the reason why we asked if we could bring this up to you today, Mike, is we are encouraging the fishing industry, the city council, the governors, the mayors, the fishing industry. We're encouraging them all to jump on board and on May 2nd help us celebrate World Tuna Day.
Okay, and I think what's going to come of this, I hope, one of the things that we talk about is the sharing of information. And I go back to this with Dr. Dalzell a lot. I know you've heard this on many other shows that we've done, Sylvia, that some of us are more likely now to share our information so that the science can be made to protect our ability to catch our fish. It really is that simple, right? Mm. If you put your head in the sand like an ostrich and say, you don't catch tombo, then they're going to say, well, then what are we even talking about? I mean, isn't it the same thing for when you start talking about quotas? Maybe you can just, on a big picture, give us how these quotas were determined and who enforces them.
Well, the quotas for Big Eye, which were in the West Central Pacific, actually started in 2005, but I think people didn't pay that much attention to them. And then it was 2008 when there was greater emphasis on, hey, you've got to stick to your quota. And the quotas were based on historical catches, mm-hmm. 2001 to 2004. But we pointed out that was a weird period for the Hawaii longland fish, who was going through all kinds of management conniptions at the time. So they just said, okay, well, the year 2004, in which year we caught 4,181 metric tons of Big Eye in the West Central Pacific Ocean. But then we had to take a 10% cut immediately.
Mm-hmm. Because of overfishing concerns? Or
no, just because it was, everybody else was taking a 10% cut. Okay. We were just sitting there, and then I think Japan raised a hand and said, hey, well, how come the U.S. isn't, this isn't fair? And so we were cut 10%. And in fact, since then, we've now been cut 20% down to 3,300 metric tons. And yet still, there's still calls for further reduction in catches, whilst the number of purse seiners over the last 10 years has grown from 200 to 300, and that we've had increasing, amount of catches on fish aggregating devices, there's a large fisheries in Indonesia and Philippines which take juvenile Big Eye.
Yes.
So this is really problematical, and it's something that the commission, the West Central Pacific Fishery Commission, has really got to come to terms with.
It seems now, and when you speak about maybe quotas, and then when you add into that closures and you add into some of the other restrictions, it's a wonder that there's anybody coming up the ladder that says, I want to be a longline fisherman, or I want to be a commercial fisherman at all. I mean, that's the biggest concern. So obviously, Sylvia, this is really kind of cool, because even our listeners, that if they go to the WPCouncil.org and can learn a little bit more about this, they can ask their representative, hey, how come you guys don't recognize tuna for us?
Right. And one thing is, we hear about, Hawaii meets its allocation.
Mm-hmm.
But again, as Paul is saying, it was based on historic, it was lowered. But compare it to what the allocation is for the Asian countries.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe Paul could give you those numbers. It's a lot higher.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, this is only for longliners. So when he's talking about fads, he's talking about purse seiners, mm-hmm. which are catching the juveniles. Yeah. Though they don't have a quota.
That's so unsettling to those of us that want, when we get our hooks through juveniles and you hook one and say, hey, stop it. They're too small. Those boats don't have a definition of too small. That's the part that's very, very concerning.
Well, also, too, is that juvenile Big Eye really don't tend to be that suitable for canning.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Eastern Pacific, there are vessels there that do deliberately target juvenile Big Eye,
yeah.
purse seiners, because there is a market for canned Big Eye.
Mm-hmm.
So it has got some fans.
What I'm concerned about is the number of places that are unfettered. I mean, we talk about this all the time. Our longline fleet, for example, is the most heavily supervised, monitored, watched in there is, and it's alarming to know how they catch their fish. And everybody that's been down at the auction, either with me or with Paul, with John Kaneko, or seen this system and seen how beautiful these fish are, they're a lot harder to catch than most of the people eating them or at the auction can understand, because most of these are coming up on a hook. We don't have this. There's not a purse seiner in our neck of the woods.
Absolutely not. Yeah. Well, you couldn't purse seiner in these latitudes anyway, with any ease.
Yeah, with any or expect a big catch either.
Yeah, there are methods called side seining, but really, you know, the American style person with this big mast and power block and the way they lift that net up, it becomes a huge sail.
Yeah.
And you need to be in the horse latitudes.
Yeah, I should say, especially in our waters, yeah.
But you need to be in the horse latitudes where winds are very slight. Mm. So, you know, it's
The reason I ask that is because many of our listeners know that we interact on a regular basis with the people from the reality show, the Wicked Tuna Show, and some of the others, and they have come to really embrace us, knowing that what we go through and knowing what they go through to catch, and more adaptation. For instance, I think we spoke about this once before, Dr. Dalzell, and that was the green stick from Japan that we use here in Hawaii is now the darling of the East Coast. They've come to POP and they've ordered their green sticks and they're down there deploying them because they have a fishery that, if you watch the series, is nothing like ours. They go up on those marks on their numbers and they anchor and they wait for the swift fish to swim by. We're out running them down, and that's what they do with the green stick when they go further to the north or to the south.
Okay, I haven't watched Wicked Tuna that much, but
it's pretty fun.
What I have seen of it is, you know, they're going fishing, I think, quite a long way offshore on a very small boat.
Yeah,
and it's all done by angling. You know, it's
And you know, by the way, when he says small boats, to us they look kind of big, but they pale in comparison to the typical longliner. The typical Wicked Tuna boat is 38 to 46 feet, 50 feet long.
Yeah,
and that's big for them.
Yeah,
but they're not out as far as our guys are, but they do go out a few hundred miles.
Yeah, I mean, our guys go a really long way north. You know, they're going up into the 30s, 35 degrees north latitude.
But I've noticed at the auction, I'm sure you have too, people say, wow, that's a big boat. It is a big boat until you put it 600 miles out to sea. Then it's a very little boat.
Very little boat.
Yeah. No 7-Elevens, no gas stations, no hospitals.
Or just put a purse seiner alongside one of our boats.
And they're pretty big. How big are they? They're pretty big.
Oh.
A couple hundred feet?
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't have the gross tonnage and stuff, but they're huge. They're big boats. And they're comfortable, too. I mean, you know, they're nice compared to, like fishing in a hotel.
Right. So, yeah, and our longliners are, by regulations, limited to a maximum size of 101 feet.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they have to be small. But some of the sharing that the UN General Assembly was encouraging is on best practices.
Mm-hmm.
And we do have best practices of catching tuna, but also we have best practices of avoiding protected species
interactions. Exactly. That's great. The hooks, the hook removers, all of these things that have been designed by our fleet that are not being used
in
other
places. Circle hooks, side setting, night setting, blue dyed bait. And we have shared those in the International Fishers Forum, which we co-hosted and organized in Honolulu, Japan, Costa Rica, and Taipei, to share that. And we've also, you know, like the Western and Central Pacific Fisheries Commission that is making all these quotas and things. The council co-hosted and organized the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th, which was the final multilateral high-level conference on highly migratory fish stocks that developed that commission. So we've always noticed that it has to be an internationally managed stock.
You know, I think that a listener would really appreciate that because we talk about day-to-day stuff, where the fish are, how to catch them, how to cook them, how to take care of them. But we don't know how many eyes are looking at us and how many innovations there have been done, not just by the council. By the way, our council, the Western Pacific Region Fishery Management Council, is one of how many councils?
Eight.
And in size, we're by far the largest.
We were half of the U.S.
So what we're doing is being looked at by a lot of people.
Right. You know? But we don't have that many people, but we depend on it because we're islands. Yeah, and you know, like you talked about, a lot of people say about us reaching the quota. You know what? We're the only country who's reached the quota. And that's because we manage our fisheries and we have the small quota because of the allocation.
And we shut down the fishery when we reach the quota. Other fleets do.
And that's why I was going to say, that's why we have something in common with the Wicked Tuna guys. Because we only see six or eight boats in the series. But there's quite a few. There's over 100.
Is that right?
Yeah. But they have a very strict quota. And in other words, once the total fleet is caught X number of 100 fish, whatever it is, it's over for the season.
Oh, right. In many respects,
but you see, they're a smaller fleet, but they're a high value catch. I mean, that bluefin that they sell that goes to Japan and goes to the finest restaurants in the world is a big dollar product.
Oh, you know, I see them coming in and then the buyer comes and I've seen fish going for $18,000.
Oh, yeah, it's unbelievable.
Regularly $10,000, $12,000.
I know that, Sylvia, our guys, we waited the boat ramps between Christmas and New Year's to catch that 100-pound ahi for $20 a pound, but it doesn't happen all that often, does it?
No, yeah, but yeah, I yeah. did see one yeah, last yeah, year. Yeah. But, you know, also about that monitoring and enforcement, you know, the council was the first fleet to have vessel monitoring system, mm-hmm. VMS, which is now yeah. used globally. So there's a lot of these best practices that the council yeah. developed that, you know, a lot of people don't know, and they're always trying to promote us as being for the commercial fishery only, where we've made, like Paul had talked about, the 0 to 50 mile closure to keep the small boats from the longliners. We did that around the northwestern Hawaiian Islands also, which became the protected species zone, which then was usurped into the monument. But so there's, if you look at our poster, if you get a copy of it, it is a limited edition.
WPCouncil.org and let your fingers do the walking. And what you're going to do is once you get there, you're going to go to WPCouncil.org/Pelagic. Pacific dash Pelagic. It's a great. This is going to be a collector's item. I really like this. And so, but there's another thing too.
Go on.
I just want to make sure that we didn't lose time in the segment to mention something else. Whether or not you're 100% in lockstep agreement, I want to compliment a young man that we had on the show on the council segment not too long ago, named Caleb McMahon, who's come up with something I think pretty interesting. That you know that it's required a lot of work because. Paul, you said inspected, or I think, Sylvia, you said inspected. Here's a guy that at one time was one of the observers, and he came to really grow an affinity to the boats, to the men, and to the fish. A real quick mention about his film.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, we've seen his film, and now it's online for people to download the entire thing. So,
A lot of us are on that, by the way. It's a fun film. But, you know, I think that just adds to the excitement that we can be a part of this World Tuna Day because, you know, I know that Native Hawaiians, and Sylvia will like this, we've always considered that Hawaii is the pico of the world, right? In other words, every place looks at us, we are in many respects, some of the things that have been, that are being observed on the second are what we do anyway. Isn't this kind of neat that we're in the middle of all this?
Yes, and so once again, we'd like to encourage everyone to, if not this year, because it's kind of a late notice, join in, plan for it in the next May 2nd.
It said, celebrating one of our planet's greatest resources. And I'm not sure whether they're referring to the ocean or to the fish, but I think they're referring to the tuna. Because like you said, Dr. Dalzell, there's tuna and then there's the rest of the stuff in Hawaii.
Yeah, I always say that, you know, the only fishery worth talking about is tuna fisheries. Mm-hmm. Everything else is just stamp collecting.
Yeah, really. But, you know, there is also a lot of concern about a lot of things, some of which you may agree with or not agree with, you know, ideologically. But climate change is a big deal. There's a lot of things that are going on that are affecting the fishery. Mm. And I think that calmer heads have got to prevail as to what stocks are and everything else. So I want to kind of finish up with we all on the 2nd of May are going to somehow celebrate or at least toast a glass to the tuna, that we ought to toast a glass to those people that are working in the industry that are, number one, quantifying what's out there, and number two, how we can catch it the most and preserve it going forward. No fisherman wants to catch the last fish.
No, absolutely not. And you know, that's one of the tragedies of modern fishing is that, you know, you can be fishing profitably right up to the moment you catch the last fish.
Exactly. And
this is practically what happened with the Peruvian anchoveta back in the 1980s.
The anchoveta? It's an anchovy, but it wasn't inches long, right?
No, that's about maybe 6 inches long.
Yeah.
But it's caught primarily for feed, agricultural feed.
Yeah.
It's one of the world's biggest fisheries, 2 million metric tons, you know, and then it just... Through a combination of circumstances, of which fishing was just one of the, fishing was one of the principal reasons, but you mentioned global warming. You know, it's environmental cycles.
Absolutely,
do have.
We had global warming, you know, BC.
Yeah, and we now know that the El Nino and the Pacific Decadal Oscillation. And possibly even things like the Atlantic Decadal Oscillation have an impact on our fish stocks. And, you know, there's been work that's shown that to the abundance of fish, some fish, is driven not so much by fisheries, but by, you know, other factors such as environmental and oceanographic factors.
Okay, that now, with that being said, I want everybody to understand a couple of things. First of all, WPCouncil.org is where you can see a lot of this stuff. But in order to celebrate this, we got to know that you're going to get on board. So once again, Sylvia, this is a very special, this is the first of what we hope is to be an annual event. But something needs to be done with it. So, I mean, something here locally needs to begin so that we can get aboard locally. What is that? I mean, with regards to getting to your educators, getting to your legislators, getting somebody to say, hey, look, the world is recognizing this, and there's nowhere in the world probably that is more dependent or reliant on tuna than we are.
Right. Well, I guess we can all get together and figure out how we're maybe going to celebrate next year, yeah, May 2nd, yeah. Every year, you know, maybe come up with an event or something.
Save the date.
Right.
Let's go save the date.
And also, you know, in our resolution, we also have asked the U.S. Department of State to present our poster and our resolution to the U.N. General Assembly so they are aware that this is an important resource to the United States Pacific Islands.
Yeah, and I think that's why I'm so glad that the initiative was taken here by us to have this poster go to the U.N. and say, okay, here, Hawaii's in, you know, right. that's a pretty nice thing. Okay, so you go to www.wpcouncil.org to find out more about this. And thanks so much for listening. Dr. Dalzell, always nice seeing you. And coming up is ahi season, so we'll be talking some more pretty soon, right?
Okay.
And Sylvia, thank you once again, too.
If
you want to hear something on the show, it's pretty easy. Drop me a line, themikebuckshow@gmail.com. themikebuckshow@gmail.com. And as always, thanks to our sponsors, particularly the Western Pacific Region Fishery Management Council, where we hope that you have, you know, big bites, sharp hooks, following seas, and leave a little, take a lot, but leave a little, so we can come back next time. See you next week. Aloha.